The cyber landscape is constantly evolving, creating new challenges and opportunities to defend against sophisticated attacks. At Northrop Grumman, we provide a wide range of capabilities to stay ahead of these threats. To learn more, visit northropgrumman.com/cyber.
Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report's weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Gas prices in the United States are rising in the wake of the cyber attack on the Colonial Pipeline that moves more than 2 billion barrels of oil and gas from the Gulf Coast up the eastern seaboard. The company shut down over the weekend after its systems were penetrated by a Russian ransomware group, DarkSide. President Biden has declared a state of national emergency in the wake of the attack, and there is great anticipation that the administration will soon disclose its new nationwide cyber executive order. This is one of the situations that was prophesized in the Cyberspace Solarium Commission report last year. For many people, was the last public event they attended before the coronavirus pandemic shut down Washington and the rest of the world. Joining us now to discuss the attack and some key lessons are retired United States Navy Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery, who is the executive director of the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, who is also a fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, the commission's deputy executive director, John Costello, and John Cofrancesco, the vice president for business development at Fortress Information Security, who's joined us several times, as has Mark. Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago.
Excellent. Great to be here. Thanks.
Thank you for having us.
And before we get started, our daily podcast is sponsored by Bell. Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our coverage of naval warfare. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems is sponsoring our air and missile defense coverage. Mark, this is almost exactly the scenario that you guys discussed, right? A ransomware company or malware that's inserted into national critical infrastructure. I know that Tom Fanning was the president of the Southern Company, one of the nation's leading utilities, was one of the Solarium Commission commissioners. Talk to us a little bit about this attack. What's new about it? What's different? What are the key lessons and takeaways from it?
Hey, so thank you very much, Vago, and thanks for taking this issue on right away, because I think it's important. You know, as Senator King said last night on a TV broadcast, how many more wake up calls are we going to get? I mean, I think the Cyberspace Solarium Commission did a pretty decent job of laying out the risk in our national critical infrastructures. The availability of tools to the adversary has been increasing exponentially. The interconnectivity of our systems through automation, which is what you see these pipelines, has been increasing exponentially. But our investment in cyber defense has been basically linear and at a low glide slope to be sure. So when your risk drivers are increasing exponentially and your risk mitigators are only increasing linearly, you're starting to develop a lot of risk. And that's what we have inside our national critical infrastructures. And it could be pipeline, it could be wastewater systems or water systems, it could be electrical distribution systems, it could be our maritime transportation system. I've mentioned a number of areas where we had concerns. They're all vulnerable to malicious cyber activity, and we're beginning to see that. And the commission made a lot of strong recommendations about how to reform the government that we did last year and how to improve government agencies like the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, last year. I think this year, you're going to see a strong push on the recommendations that the commission had and recommendations that other people, the commission wasn't alone in this, but the congressional committees and outside groups have had about how you build a better public-private collaboration, how you identify your critical functions in the economy, like a pipeline service like Colonial Pipeline, and what kind of partnership you build between the government and those private sector entities. And we're fortunate to have John Costello here because he's really been the lead thinker on how we build that relationship between the private and public sectors among the critical functions.
Mark, excellent queuing up. You're a frequent enough guest where you know the racket really well. John, I want to bring you into the discussion, right? I mean, what's the right way to do this? Tom Fanning was talking about the obligation that companies have, right? Make this as part of financial disclosures, because absent the sunlight, companies have a tendency of wanting to shovel this under the rug, right? If they invest too much, then people go, oh my God, they have a problem. Or, if there is no attention, maybe that's a positive thing from generally a market's perspective. What's the right way to get that right balance between commercial obligation and government requirement, if you will?
That's a very good question, Vago. It's one that I don't think we answer specifically directly in the report, but we certainly make, I think, a distinction. And I think this is a very important one. I think between larger, more critical companies that certainly have sufficient margins to make sufficient investments in their cybersecurity infrastructure, and smaller companies who may not be able to get there, and really are the ones could benefit from sort of greater government programs and government assistance. I think the way we sort of view public-private collaboration here is really on three levels. I think the top and first and foremost is information sharing and putting forward a program like a joint collaborative environment where there's common access rather than sort of sharing of information. Second is planning, where you can actually meet with some of these larger companies and envision scenarios like a ransomware attack on a pipeline and start to prepare yourself in thinking about the types of things you need to do so that government and private sector can take action at the same time without even necessarily a fulsome discussion. You both know you have a common plan. And the third really is really person-to-person interaction in a type of center. There is no substitute for two humans sitting down and working together and sharing information and throwing things across the transom. As to whether sort of what's the balance between public obligation that's a really hard question, I think, to answer. I think what it really comes down to is what should we expect at a bare minimum from good corporate citizenship, and what is a rule that we can apply across the ecosystem that is inherently stabilizing without being unduly burdensome. I know that's not a direct answer to what you're asking, but I think it's those are the two things that I would look at for sort of what should be required, if that makes sense.
It does, right? I mean, but again, that's been the challenge. We haven't wanted to be burdensome, but then those who have an obligation to defend what's important, whether it's intellectual priority or physical infrastructure, end up sort of almost sliding off the hook in a sense. And then we all have a tendency of dealing with the aftermath of these things, whether it's with a data breach or with anything else, or even protecting government networks, as we saw in the case of the OPM hacks. John, I want to bring you into the discussion. Obviously, you're in the information security business. You're also a thinker in this space. One of the things that you and I have discussed is this sort of excessive, perhaps, focus on information technology as opposed to operational technology. Talk to us about that OT versus IT push-pull and where you think actually intellectually we might not be approaching this with the right model given the challenge we face.
Well, I think that for most folks, they don't even know the definition between IT and OT. So IT is information technology. Think about the laptop that you're using to write your Word documents or your PowerPoints. OT is technology that's probably driven by some laptops, but it physically does something. So it moves the oil, it moves the gas. And we actually look at the dispersion of investment in our critical infrastructure. What we'll find is that there's been a great deal of money in relative terms spent on IT, but relatively little spent on OT. And this is problematic because if somebody hacks a laptop and steals some intellectual property, that's very bad, but it usually doesn't have material outcomes in terms of people's lives, right? Nobody dies, nothing blows up. People can still get gas. When OT gets attacked, like we have here, the gas goes away, the power gets turned off. Somebody could die, we have an explosion. So I think what we need to do as a country is start looking at outcomes-based assessments of where we need to invest. So we need to say, hey, these are the industries, these are the places that if something goes wrong in this particular segment, we're going to have major, major lifestyle changing impacts.
Mark, their ransomware attacks, I know that in the commission has been extended. One of the things you talked about was cybercrime when you joined us late last year in terms of what the priorities for the commission are going to be going forward in its extension. And God willing, it will get further extended because unfortunately we have a lot of work to do. Ransomware has positively exploded. In this case, it's a Russian company. There are concerns that there are links to the Russian state. The unfortunate reality is just about everybody in the modern Russian kleptocratic government industrial order is somehow has a dotted line linkage to it. Do we have the right approach to addressing this ransomware problem that has gotten orders of magnitude worse, or at least maybe the reporting has become more public? I mean, there are different ways of looking at it. We saw this impact major cities. Baltimore, as you would expect, told the ransomware organization, which I think had North Korean links, to shove it, and pretty much they said, keep all the data, we'll rebuild it from scratch. What's the right approach we need to, in the more immediate sense, on ransomware as we try to get to an overall better place, I guess?
Well, you're right. As we discussed a few weeks ago, you know, ransomware is introducing criminal activity throughout the infrastructure. In other words, if you went back 20 years historically, the financial services sector was the one experiencing criminal behavior. That's because, you know, these were attempting to break into systems electronically and pirate money. What's happened, obviously, with ransomware is the criminals have figured out how to monetize almost any data by either denying your access to it if it's a payment system, denying your control of it if it's an operational technology system or an OT-driven system, or beginning to release it, you know, in a reputational damage sort of way. So all those are elements of the blackmail that the ransomware criminals can use. So ransomware really has introduced malicious cyber activity throughout the critical infrastructure. So it's created a bigger problem. I think I'd cycle back on one thing that John was getting at. And as we tackle ransomware, what it means now is all of the 85% of the national critical infrastructure that's owned and operated by the private sector needs to begin to embrace the, you know, the higher standards of cybersecurity that we saw the banking industry because of the criminal threat they had, the telecom industry because of their relationship with their vulnerability to state actors penetrating their systems and also criminal activity. And we saw in the electrical power generation where they have invested due to regulatory requirements and higher level cybersecurity. So the whole rest of the infrastructure needs to match that. And John developed a provision called systemically important critical infrastructure that really talks about, hey, you've got some burdens. If you're a national critical function, as Colonial Pipeline would be, there's burdens on you. You have to meet a certain level of security that involves that it would involve a third party assessment, so the government knew you were meeting it, and you have to report incidents to us within hours, minutes or hours, not weeks or months. And as you know, they've never really reported this incident to CISA. It's only the FBI that's been aware, you know, been made aware by Colonial of what's happened. And then because you have those burdens, you'd get some benefits: increased access to intelligence, maybe an ability to shape the intelligence collection environment, and potentially liability protection if you met all the security requirements,
right,
and you were attacked by an advanced threat. So I kind of think that's how we're going to get at getting the critical infrastructure right. That's not going to help Ted's dry cleaner down the street, but it is going to help Colonial Pipeline, Dominion Power, the several hundred critical functions that really drive our economic and national security in the national critical infrastructure. So I think they do it. If I could comment on one other thing, we are diving down a little bit to help small and medium-sized businesses and people who are attacked by this, by ransomware and other malicious cyber activity, with a National Cybercrime Recovery Center. It's not where you report your initial crime, but it's where law enforcement pushes you and other agencies push you so that you can get support and how you recover from this kind of event. If you're a small or medium-sized business, or if you're a general citizen who's been a victim of cybercrime.
John Costello.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a few things here. First of all, Mark, I think hit some of the major points. I think one of the biggest problems, I think, as you mentioned, is how to how to provide some type of requirement that's fairly universal. In the realm of requirements, I think that's, you know, that's most often talked about is incident reporting. So when a company gets hit with an incident or discovers an incident, their obligation to inform the federal government. There's a lot of questions about thresholds. Well, what is an incident? You know, we get hit with thousands per day. If we're talking about port scanning, we don't really know how bad an incident is. It could be days, it could be weeks before we discover the full extent. But ransomware is one of those, is sort of an easily identified incident. And I think one of the few ones that I would say is it's very clear this is something that should be, I think, reported to the federal government. I think at a sort of a very base level, you know, we should expect that companies, I think of all stripes, when they get hit with a ransomware attack, should be required to inform the federal government. And this allows for a few things. I think it allows for early intervention, so companies can get help when they need it, and can have a broader set of calculus before they were to pay a ransom. I think the other thing, and I got to sort of give a hat tip over to the Institute for Security and Technology's Ransomware Task Force here. I think we do need to have more work in looking at the financial supply chain, if you will, for some of these criminals, in much in the same way we looked at terrorist financing in the early 2000s with our anti-money laundering efforts. Cash out or the ability to take illicit gains and to launder them into hard currency is the most vulnerable part of any sort of criminal enterprise. And we know cryptocurrencies play a big role. This isn't to demonize cryptocurrencies, but we know that they can be very easily used are commonly used for these types of attacks. I think, you know, figuring out how we can focus on cash out, transfer, uh-huh, when they're trying to take that money and to bring it back into the global financial system, under some type of cover, I think is a good way to try to attack those money laundering efforts. And it is another way to exert pressure to try to, I think, diminish some of these attacks over time. But if I could just follow up on what Mark said, the systemically important critical infrastructure piece is one where we looked squarely at companies like Colonial Pipeline, and we asked ourselves, what does a true partnership look like? Not one that's sort of like head nodded as like, hey, we should work together, but one where the government extends its full support to a company, but in return, you know, expects the company to do its utmost in its cybersecurity efforts, whether it's incident reporting, whether it's increased standards. We would expect companies to benefit from intelligence, direct intelligence from the federal government to support their operations, and certain liability protections if they get hit with an advanced attack. I think in my mind, that is the way of the future, because so much of our critical infrastructure is owned and operated by the private sector. I don't see any other way of us moving forward.
John Cofrancesco, I want to get into sort of the software and the hardware sausage with you a little bit. You wrote a great commentary on our website. Now's the time to know what's in the software sausage, right? That there's code that we don't know the provenance of. There's hardware that we don't know the provenance of. Talk to us about the role of greater sort of end-to-end visibility, right? I mean, things have part numbers from a prime contractor that were actually acquired from a subcontractor that was acquired from a commercial contractor that actually includes what could be some very openly available Chinese componentry and Chinese software, some of which could have malicious code in it, some of which doesn't. And there's a tendency of us not wanting to really focus on it because it's got we assume that just because it's gone through various levels that it's secure. How do we need to think sort of end to end about this challenge? Because Colonial clearly has componentry that's in its architecture that is unsecure or can be manipulated easily.
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that these companies are profit driven, right? And there's a real market inefficiency here. So if you're Colonial or or you're any organization that isn't strictly regulated to have a cybersecurity level up to a certain par, they're never going to do it because it isn't in their financial interest to do so. It's certainly not in the short run. That so when we talk about supply chain, one of the things to consider is that, is it cheaper to get a part that may have a gray background, or is it cheaper to get a part where you really understand down to the component level, down to the software component level, what's in it? And the reality is today, it is much cheaper for you as an organization to get that part where maybe you don't know. Maybe it has some vulnerability, maybe it doesn't, because there isn't a financial penalty to you if you choose to go with the cheaper part. There isn't a regulation forcing you, twisting your arm to do it. So we really have to look at this from a market efficiency perspective first to understand, until we make a market driver, probably a regulation, the majority of the critical infrastructure isn't going to do this. And then the second, at a national level, we need to understand that just like on a food with the food paradigm, right? I want to know that what I'm eating, what I get at my lunch table is not poisoned. We ought to have that same level of concern around what goes into our IT and OT, because today there's a lot of security theater that goes on, but not as much true security, true understanding of what's going on at that end level of the supply chain.
Mark, you're one of the least theatrical people I know. How do we take the theater out of it and focus on this? And I want to take the conversation in a second to military systems, right? As easily as you could hit Colonial Pipeline, there is a lot of military infrastructure that is still vulnerable. Now, what, 2-3 years after Michael Baer and Ron Moultrie did their sort of seminal report for Navy Secretary Spencer, that said the most existential challenge the Navy faces is actually the vulnerability of its cyber vulnerabilities. How do we need to get this right and move away, Mark, from theater to actually concrete actions, even if they cost, this is costing us billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars, ultimately, right? I mean, so we're all paying a price already. How do we need to think about that cost-benefit analysis, which, you know, as John says, is often, you know, and both John said and you said, right? I mean, is often missing in the discussion.
Yeah, thanks. Well, first, I just want to double down on what John Cofrancesco said there. He's absolutely right. You know, how do you introduce security into that market-based decision? How do you evaluate that so that, you know, you'll pay an extra 4% for something that has an improved security, an extra 8%, whatever it is. And so that's a critical issue. Now, the good news when you turn this to Department of Defense is, we routinely spend more money on things. So, you know, the idea is they need to value it. The problem in the Department of Defense has been that cybersecurity is usually built into like an acquisition program on the front end. You'll see it in the initial bills, in the initial build of a acquisition program. But then as that system starts to have either get salami slice cuts because a decision is made to prioritize something else temporarily and they have to cut things, you see cybersecurity start to slip away there as there's a new variation that they want slightly introduced to a weapon system, and you have to make cuts across the total program of that system. That's when you see cybersecurity start to go away. So GAO did a fantastic report 2 years ago at the request of the Senate. They could do it again today and you'd have the same answer, which is that in the end, our major acquisition programs of you know, the weapon systems that we know and love, you know, that protect us, cybersecurity has routinely not been delivered with the program. And then of course, trying to craft cybersecurity and splice it into a system later on is extremely expensive, ineffective, and certainly inefficient in your money spending. And so, you know, for the Department of Defense, it's not that the cost is the problem, it's maintaining the prioritization of cybersecurity throughout the acquisition process. You tend to see it in the beginning, you don't see it in the end. And if I could add one other thing, is we really have to go back now, and as expensive as it might be, we have to determine that when we have something that is secure, some new fifth generation system that actually has cybersecurity designed into it, if it's going to operate with legacy systems, how do we build the network? You know, how do we build cybersecurity into the network that integrates those two systems so the legacy system doesn't take down the fifth generation system that might otherwise have an inherent cybersecurity defense built into it? So the Department of Defense can do it. It takes an attention to detail and a prioritization on cybersecurity that GAO has reported is not consistently there.
John Costello, I should note you come from a Navy background as well. Another one of the smart crypto people who was pushed into a cyber billet. So well done on that. We have a surface warrior here, and John comes from a commercial background. But sort of give us your sense on where we need to go, right? New administration getting in the saddle and starting to look at all of these as sort of more urgent priorities.
So, you know, I think the report last year, I think set a framework for certainly where we need to go. You know, I think a base thing, one of the provisions sort of we passed in the National Defense Authorization Act last year was continuity of the economy planning. And this envisioned a scenario, and this was before the pandemic, where an attack or any sort of either small scale or large scale disruption, you know, cause and effect widespread enough to where there would be sort of disruptions in conveyance of goods or services across the economy. And it directed the federal government to identify those scenarios. And like we do with continuity of government and continuity of the presidency and continuity of operations, to come up with a series of plans by which we could rapidly restart or mobilize the economy. And we saw this with the pandemic, where a sort of a widespread disruption can cause availability issues, can cause conveyance issues of goods and services. But oil and natural gas pipelines were were specifically mentioned in our report and in the legislation that directs the federal government to come up with this planning. I think that has to really be a priority. And part of that is what Mark said a little bit earlier, is to identify what those critical functions are. It should be clear that at least for now, you know, oil is the lifeblood of the economy, for now at least. And the conveyance of oil and availability of oil, you know, across the East Coast, across the country, is very clearly a national critical function that needs to be protected. I think that has to be a major priority, because that really sets the stage as far as rigor is concerned about what really is important. What may be less important, and where we need to focus our efforts, what companies we need to focus our efforts on, and really where we need to go. I think we have to do that rigorous analysis now, so that we can prioritize our investment for the best impact.
I want to go to John Cofrancesco. Mark is about to turn into a pumpkin. So John, give us your answer. And I have one last question for Mark before we part. Go ahead.
Well, I think the last NDAA made some good steps, but in practice, we have some major cultural issues when we talk about security in the military-industrial complex. And I'm going to give you a hard example. So in the last NDAA, basically a regulation came out, NDAA 889, said, don't use Huawei, Daiwa, all of these companies that are really backed by the Chinese military-industrial complex. And in practice, that ought to do the job. But in reality, what has gone on is that our prime vendors, rather than actually looking at the material they're providing to the military, they just get affidavits from their second tier vendors. And if you go to the second tier vendors, rather than checking to make sure that their components don't have Huawei or ZTE vulnerabilities, they just get affidavits from their third tier vendors. So what I really think we need here is a real cultural change, where the organizations who pass the buck or play three card Monty with security, they take on meaningful liability. And I think that attaches right back to this colonial attack. Is anybody going to lose their job over this? Is anybody going to go to jail over this? Probably not. And until we have those type of cultural changes, we're likely to see these type of attacks continue.
Mark, is John on the right track on that? And I just want to ask one last question, which is holding people to account. Go ahead.
So yeah, John's absolutely right that you have to have accountability in your supply chain, in your software bill of materials, and kind of passing it down, passing the buck down the chain, doesn't work, because you eventually get to a company that's so small, it's not in a position to actually do a meaningful evaluation of the security of its product.
And Mark, last question. And if you got to punch out, I understand after you give us the answer, President Biden has responded in the first, President Biden has issued the first part of the retaliation against Russia for its massive cyber hack against the United States, the SolarWinds attack. The United States has not yet fully responded to the Chinese attack, which might even be bigger, the Microsoft attack. Are we responding the right way punitively across the piece, whether against cyber criminals or whether it's against nation states? Because as you said, I mean, we keep going from one Pearl Harbor to the other Pearl Harbor, and nobody appears really to be learning the lesson or not learning the lesson as quickly enough.
Well, I think that you have to, you know, your response has to be across, you know, a series of government capabilities. So first is law enforcement. I do think we should produce a case against the ransomware criminals. I don't believe it'll be processed inside the Russian system, and I certainly don't believe anyone would be extradited. But you still have to do that law enforcement work in these cases. The second thing you have to do is look at the effectiveness of sanctions. There's sanctions you can do against individuals and sanctions you can do against certain government entities in Russia where you just see some specific, or corporate entities in Russia where you just see some specific linkage. In the absence of that, you could begin to put DarkSide, you know, their ransomware as a service product in the sanctions regime, where you're not allowed to pay a ransom for you. You would be violating a broader sanctions regime if you did it. We already have some Russian systems like NotPetya and a number of Iranian criminal software systems in that categorization. And what that does is makes it illegal to pay a ransom. That will make the business case a little bit harder for people wanting to use DarkSide DarkSide ransomware attack system. And then finally, I think we have to begin to, you know, we have to establish a baseline of defend forward and persistent engagement amongst the Russian Russia-based criminal networks, so that we can raise that level when we see an action like this, you know, to signal, hey, you need to stop this, or to just eliminate its ability to do it. And it's a difficult thing. Attacking the cyber infrastructure of a non-state is hard because the non-state moves around, but we do have to introduce some friction into the ransomware criminals' day-to-day behavior, raise the cost of doing business for them. I think it's much harder than going at a nation state, but it's something that can be done. And I think it would be appropriate if there's a finding inside the White House under the Trump administration known as NSPM, National Security Presidential Memorandum 13, that allowed the kind of offensive operations that are necessary to begin to impose cost on these criminal networks.
Mark, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Vago. Real pleasure to be here today.
John and John, very briefly, as we wrap up, let me ask two different questions of each of you. John Costello, do you know, classification has been held up as being a major problem in this, right? That everything that deals with cyber is so classified that effectively learning lessons becomes very, very problematic. We talked to Chris Cleary, one of the Navy's top cyber advisor, about this, and that it was a challenge. It makes it very hard to learn lessons. Do we need to take a different approach to classification writ large? As a general rule, people tend to want to stay very private when it comes to any breach, and governments are even worse because oftentimes it's sort of like, well, you left a sandwich, you know, password was ABC123. The sandwich was, you know, sitting on a table and the bear ate the sandwich. So not to overdo Russia analogies here, right? Or the panda ate the bamboo shoot, right? How do we need to think about that? And John, if you will, sort of what's the role of industry in a punitive holding to account mechanism? Go ahead.
Excellent. Thanks, Vago. The issue of classification is a strong one. I mean, so, you know, from the government standpoint, it's a difficult situation. The intelligence community is in really a no-win situation. Their goal is to provide actionable intelligence to policymakers. And cyber, you know, cyber intrusions and cyber surveillance is one method by which they, you know, they can do that, you know, the best. And they have a natural inclination to be able to protect those accesses so they can continue to provide intelligence information. You know, providing that to CISA or providing that to companies or providing that to the FBI, who could take action and betray that access, you know, makes them go through a, you know, an intel gain loss process. I think that's a difficult situation, I think, to for the intelligence community to be in. I think it harkens to the fact that, you know, we certainly need to try to figure out ways to expand intelligence collection to take pressure off of that process so we can share more when we do have some certain indicators that, you know, enemy is planning an attack or what the plans and intentions of an adversary are. I think there's also, you know, an opportunity here to make better use of proprietary and open source information on behalf of the intelligence community. And, you know, the intelligence can be a cycle, taking non-classified intel and enriching it with certain classified information or finding ways to parallel construct what we know in classified sources through, you know, in open source proprietary intelligence is also another, you know, viable avenue to provide companies with something that can help protect them, but without betraying the sources and methods that the intelligence community relies on.
Co-Francesco?
Well, I think that Mark really hit on the most important point when we talk about ransomware and then in industry. So on the ransomware end, and it's worth noting, if we just made it illegal to pay these ransoms, there would be problems, but a lot of this would go away in terms of the ransomware. In terms of cybersecurity, that's not going to go away because there's always going to be state actors and there's always going to be those who are going to try to advance their attacks, regardless of what is legal or illegal. On the industry side, fortunately, industry has a plethora of solutions. A lot of what we're facing, we already have the solution for. It isn't a lack of supply, rather it's a lack of demand, right? That's the companies like Colonial, they have some cybersecurity put in place, but without a market driver, without a regulation forcing them to take the step, they'll never do what's absolutely necessary to bring themselves to full security. And ultimately, the game that they're playing is, it's like men being chased by a bear. You got to have one friend that's slower than you are. Colonial just happened to be the slower, fatter friend this time. We have to change that paradigm in order to make our country safe.
And I want to point out, there's nothing personal aimed at Colonial in that analogy, but point well taken. Guys, thanks very much for joining us. John Costello, John Co-Francesco, thanks very much. Look forward to having you guys back on again as we continue to cover this, especially to see whether or not, right, I mean, I should have said this at the top of the program, there is no, and the president has said, no direct established link between DarkSide and the Russian state. Obviously, intelligence community continues to scrutinize that. But as I recall, the president said that there was no intelligence was not to did not find a direct link between the organization and Russian intelligence. So important to make that clear. Thanks so very much again for joining us.
Excellent. Thanks, Vago.
Thank you.
Everyone is a contributor at Northrop Grumman, and every day is an opportunity to help defend our nation and our allies. Visit our careers page at ngc.com to learn about joining the Cyber and Intelligence Mission Solutions team.